Nearly 45 years ago, with the insight of all great poets, William Butler Yeats wrote something which, as a diagnosis of the human condition, might well have been said, and perhaps more pertinently, today. The lines are these. Things fall apart. The center cannot hold. Mere anarchy is loosed upon the world. The blood-dimmed tide is loosed, and everywhere the ceremony of innocence is drowned. The best lack all conviction, while the worst are full of passionate intensity.
United Nations Radio presents Alexander Scorby with Thoughts in a Hall, a program for United Nations Day 1965, the 20th year of a combined effort to save succeeding generations from the scourge of war.
I'm sitting here alone. Well, almost alone. Way behind me up in a gallery, an attractive and well-informed girl, one of the UN guides, is talking to a group of visitors.
This room is, of course, the General Assembly. This is the largest room in the whole United Nations, the one under the dome that we saw back at the model.
As I was saying, you cannot see the dome. I'm sitting here under the dome because, well, just a minute.
Now you see all these beige tables down here covered over in green. These are where the various delegations sit. We have 10 delegates accredited to the General Assembly from each country, 2 countries sharing each table. So the 3 top people from each country, the ambassador...
Ah, yes, the delegates. They're not here at the moment. As I said, I'm alone, except for the guide and her tour. But that's why I chose this place, to ponder that poem. This place was built to bring people together. The best and the worst, the unconvinced and the passionate. And if things really are falling apart, if mere anarchy is loose, then they, our representatives, had better start turning the blood-dimmed tide in a more constructive direction.
This is, as I say, the real area of work and the real reason for the success of an organization like the UN or any other international organization. This is the basic work of the United Nations. Any questions?
Success? Any questions? Yes, indeed. Plenty. George Orwell, in his famous nightmare, 1984, saw the world divided into a few mutually antagonistic regions, fear-ridden federations which never actually attacked each other on a grand scale, but which, through their ministries of peace, maintained an endless series of small peripheral wars, with just an occasional missile landing in a metropolitan area to remind the spiritless masses that their neighbors are still hostile. Are we, I wonder, entering this period ahead of schedule? Or are we, like lemmings in an incoherent stampede, stumbling into a situation that will lack even the horrid subtlety of the Orwellian order? Relying pathetically and increasingly not on wisdom, but on machines to determine our destiny. Well, perhaps I sense more menace than there is, but in the midst of all the alerts and alarms, the accusations and justifications flashed around the world in a ceaseless torrent, it sometimes seems as if we're all suffering from some strange form of paranoia. And it also sometimes seems as if we're suffering from something else as well. Paralysis, immobility, stagnation, a complete inability to move ahead along any course plotted by reason. You'd like some evidence? All right, let me play extracts from 2 speeches, separated in time by 17 years, but disturbingly similar in content. The first is by the UN's first Secretary General, Trygve Lie, speaking at the end of 1947.
We could not have expected that this period in the immediate aftermath of a world catastrophe would be free of troubles. What we did hope for was steady progress back toward a normal world in which human beings could pursue their lives in freedom from fear and hunger and the many problems which afflict humanity. Yet we have been disappointed in the greatest hope of all. The hope that the great powers would be able to move definitely and progressively toward an understanding on the questions which divided them.
17 years after that, the UN's third Secretary General, U Thant, cared no more for what he could see than did Mr. Lee.
We have a major ideological split in our world, represented on both sides by powerful military alliances. We have the division between the rich and the poor, now starkly emphasized by the tremendous technological successes of the more advanced countries and the mushrooming populations of some of the less advanced ones. We may well see, if we are not very careful, the cancer of racialism spreading across the world. In addition, we have around the world all sorts of situations which at any moment may spark a conflagration which can easily spread to far wide areas with disastrous results.
U Thant spoke those words exactly a year ago. And in the light of what has happened since then, it's almost a miracle that there hasn't been a flaming disaster. But no, that's wrong. There's nothing miraculous about it. Behind and often obscured by all of today's violence and vituperation, folly and fanaticism, something better is taking shape. Let me play an extract from a third speech, given roughly midway between the last two. The speaker is the UN's second Secretary General, the late Dag Hammarskjöld, and the date is 1958.
As contemporaries, we are apt to be too much swayed by the immediacy of danger and conflict and to lose sight of the positive responses that are also evoked by the underlying need for more effective world organization. To move towards solutions which will make the future of the nations more secure than it is today, we need to take whatever steps we can toward reducing the tensions and toward blunting the sharp edges of conflict.
Some of the steps taken over the past 20 years, in the hindsight of future historians, and when the arguments about some of them have been forgotten, may well be declared longer and greater than we consider them today. Steps such as these, for example. A Sunday afternoon in June 1950, Trygve Lie addresses an urgent meeting of the Security Council.
At midnight yesterday, I was informed that the conflict appeared to have broken out in Korea. I immediately dispatched telegrams to the United Nations Commission in Korea asking for a report. This morning the reply of the commission was received and it has been circulated as a document.
And it confirmed the fears of all. Then there were the early hours of a Friday in November 1956. The General Assembly was holding its first emergency session on the Suez Crisis. And at about 3 a.m., Lester B. Pearson, then Canada's foreign minister, went to the speaker's rostrum.
The armed forces of Israel and of Egypt are to withdraw, or if you like, to return to the armistice lines, where they will presumably, if this is done, once again face each other in fear and hatred. What then? What then 6 months from now? Are we to go through this all again? I would have liked to see a provision authorizing the Secretary General to begin to make arrangements with member governments for a United Nations force large enough to keep these border that peace while a political settlement is being worked out.
The idea that produced UNIF, the United Nations Emergency Force in the Middle East, where peace being a fragile thing in that area, it remains to this day. And then there was a day in December 1960 when Dag Hammarskjöld said to the Security Council,
withdraw the United Nations force, and it is my fear everything would crumble. Short of a substitute being created for the force from outside, with all that this means.
These, of course, were the days of agony in the Congo.
If and when that were to happen, the world would be facing a confused Spanish war situation with fighting going on all over the prostrate body of the Congo and pursued for nebulous and conflicting aims.
And then again, there was a day in February last year when U Thant said,
needless to say, without the Security Council concurrence, the question of the Secretary General sending a peacekeeping force to Cyprus will not arise.
But the Council did concur, and UNFISIP, the UN Cyprus Force, went to the island, where it is still on duty today. About it, Lord Caradon, representing the United Kingdom, a power directly concerned with this particular problem, recently said,
"To stand between the living and the dead and stay the plague, that has from ancient times been the duty of leadership. That has been the honorable role of the United Nations in Cyprus."
Add to those steps many more. The mediators, the observers, the special representatives, the UN presence in trouble spots too numerous to mention. Among many who have noted this UN armory of peace is Norway's ambassador to the organization, Sivert Nielsen.
The magnitude of the work of the United Nations to safeguard peace in the last 20 years is maybe best illustrated by the fact that approximately 140,000 uniformed personnel coming from 52 member states have served with the United Nations under the blue helmets of that organization in the service of peace in one or more of these missions. More than 300 men have lost their lives in the service of peace with the United Nations. Be it our consolation that they did not give their lives in vain.
Now, of course, there's often good reason to take official speeches with more than one grain of salt. Just as a fashionable portrait painter knows how to blur the blemishes on a rich patron's face, so the diplomat's technique must include clichés for all occasions. However, in this context, there are equally good reasons to take official speeches seriously. Mr. Nielsen was one of the delegates who gathered in San Francisco last June to commemorate the 20th anniversary of the signing of the UN Charter, and it was no time for platitudes. With the UN in grave financial difficulties, and with the world's political climate dangerously unsettled, there was at the meeting a rather refreshing absence of fulsome rhetoric. Instead, there were close and clear examinations of what the Charter really means, in fact and by implication, and of the obligations it imposes or should impose upon those who subscribe to it. Inevitably, such examinations were made from differing viewpoints, but at the same time they all contained an encouraging element of unanimity. Let's recall a couple. The ambassador of the Soviet Union, for example, Nikolai Fedorenko.
Sometimes one hears voices calling for revision of the United Nations Charter and its basic provisions. Is it not obvious that the argument that the Charter of the United Nations is allegedly imperfect is not the crux of the matter? The reason lies in the fact that the possibilities that the Charter offers have not, up till now, been always and fully utilized and put into practice.
And the ambassador of France, Roger Seydoux.
Comme la guerre, la paix ne peut être gagnée que si les plus puissants.
The peace, like the war, can only be won if those with the most power find a way to regain their unanimity. The results are sometimes disappointing when we act on this obvious truth. But attempts which have been made to avoid it appear to carry far greater risks. Would they not, if successful, permanently impair the unity, the prestige, and the very functioning of an organization whose universal character cannot be sacrificed to the interests of any coalition, however broad?
All right. If the Charter's inherent possibilities have not been used to the full, if the powerful, and for that matter, the weak, frequently find themselves divided, where does the trouble lie? In his San Francisco speech last June, Secretary General Thant voiced a pretty convincing answer to that question.
The greatest obstacle to the realization of the Charter is the inescapable fact that power politics still operates, both overtly and covertly, in international relations. The concept of power politics, whether as the instrument of nationalism or of ideological extremism, is the natural enemy of international order as envisaged in the Charter.
And the alternative?
Patriotism, national pride, or ideological conviction can and must take new and more creative forms than the old concepts of political domination or material power.
There are those, of course, who fear such thoughts, those for whom the very word international is anathema. Fortunately, there are others, and I hope they're in the majority, who have long understood that to enter into international agreements, to sign treaties, to work in multinational enterprises is an exercise of sovereignty, not an abrogation of it. The 52 governments who have provided the 140,000 men for UN peacekeeping operations are certainly in the latter group. So are those represented on the committee which in recent months has been wrestling with the formidable difficulty surrounding the question of UN peacekeeping. They've never suggested that the UN should not engage in such operations, or even that ultimately there should be a permanent UN force for peace. Heaven knows it's big and complicated enough, but the only question is, how should peacekeeping operations be organized, conducted, and financed? Now, it seems to me that the very fact that a debate like this is going on, not only within the formal framework of the UN, but publicly and privately all over the world, is evidence that there's a very positive undercurrent slowly gaining strength below the turbulent surface of our time. And if you turn to fields which are certainly influenced by politics, but not dominated by them, the undercurrent is both visible and tangible.
I would like very briefly to state why I believe that there can be, in the second 5 years of the decade, a great surge forward toward the goal for which we are all striving, a world without want by the end of this century.
This is Paul Hoffman, Managing Director of the UN Special Fund, which in partnership with the Technical Assistance Program, the World Bank Group, and all the specialized and technical agencies of the World Organization, is engaged in something only vaguely conceived 20 years ago, an internationally organized and operated assault on human misery, misery that rises in an anguished and impatient cry from the villages of Asia, Africa, and Latin America, and from their spreading cities.
First is a sharply increased understanding of what is involved in helping low-income countries to modernize their economies. No longer is it thought that the mere exporting of know-how and dollars is all that is needed. We now know that the process of development is one of the most complex of all human undertakings. It involves all the social disciplines, psychology, anthropology, political science, law, as well as sophisticated economic planning. Finally, there was a growth in understanding that successful development demands, above all, a deep and genuine interest and sustained effort on the part of all concerned with improving the lot of human beings.
Those most directly concerned, direct in the very real sense that they work with the villager, the farmer, the technical trainee, and the teacher, are the experts recruited for the many and varied technical cooperation projects. Over the years, there have been more than 13,000 of them. And here's a point. They've been drawn from 90 different nationalities. A comment from David Owen, Executive Chairman of the Technical Assistance Board.
This constitutes, more than ever, one of the elements which give the expanded program its unique character and an unusual capacity to respond to special requirements of language, cultural background, and techniques, and occasionally to the special needs of politically sensitive situations. Moreover, the traffic in knowledge and experience moves both ways. The expanded program, like the activities of the international organizations as a whole, opens to professionals of many countries a variety of new experience which would be unlikely otherwise to come their way.
From such a wide spectrum of activity, it's not easy to select an illustration, but I have chosen one. Not because it's typical, but because it's unique, and because it was concerned with what has been called the most preoccupying question of all. This is the question of population growth, particularly in the low-income countries. In many of them, the statistics on people are smothering those on economic growth, and some of them are trying to do something about it. India was the first. Almost 10 years ago, the Indian government made family planning an integral part of the National Development Program. But the difficulties are great in a country with 500,000 villages, and the impact of the idea was negligible. Earlier this year, therefore, the government turned to the UN. And here's the man who subsequently headed the international team of experts who visited the subcontinent, Sir Colville Devereux, Secretary General of the International Planned Parenthood Federation.
This is the first time that the United Nations has responded to the request of a national government to supply a mission purely for the family planning field. I think that is a fact which has not escaped notice in other circles.
The UN mission's terms of reference were to assess the present situation in India and advise the government on how its family planning program might be accelerated to bring the birth rate down to about 25 per thousand as soon as possible. The Indian health authorities had, even before the mission arrived, conducted successful experiments with an intrauterine device called the Loop, and the mission agreed that this could be the answer. Of future prospects, Sir Colville Devereux says,
"We believe that rapid progress will be made in the towns, in the big cities, in the towns, and at the district level with a program of this nature. And we would then suggest that as the program gathers impetus, that it should be brought out into the rural areas by teams of doctors operating from the district level."
I don't know. Facing such a contradictory panorama, one hesitates to reach definite conclusions or make precise predictions. Our brittle security could still be shattered by one impetuous act. Poverty still numbs the bodies and spirits of millions. Injustice still pollutes the lives of millions more. And yet, we have learned so much. We have in store so much experience. We are aware, as we have never been before, of where we stand and what we can do. The late Adlai Stevenson was one of the many who have grasped this totality. 5 days before he died, he delivered his last speech at a UN meeting. And in the last paragraph of that last speech, the man so many were so soon to mourn said,
"We travel together, passengers on a little spaceship, dependent on its vulnerable reserve of air and soil, all committed for our safety to its security and peace, preserved from annihilation only by the care, the work, and I will say the love that we give to our fragile craft. We cannot maintain it half fortunate, half miserable, half confident, half despairing, half slave to the ancient enemies of man, half free in a liberation of resources. No craft, no crew can travel safely with such vast contradictions. On their resolution then depends the survival of us all."
No, the best do not lack all conviction. Mere anarchy is still in check. The dams of reason still hold back the blood-dimmed tide. As I said, I've been sitting here alone in the assembly hall. But it isn't always so deserted. Delegates will gather here again. For this is the place where dreams become responsibilities, where convictions become obligations. And the delegates are the crew of our craft. And 3.5 billion passengers are relying on them.
Thoughts in a Hall was a program for United Nations Day 1965. produced by United Nations Radio and narrated by Alexander Scorby.